Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine Podcast Radio. You're about to listen to an episode of Tech Done Different Podcast with Ted Harrington. Do you follow the pack or challenge the status quo? Join Ted as he explores how to succeed by going against conventional wisdom. You'll hear leaders in technology and security tell stories about how they achieve their success by doing things differently. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Tech Done Different. I'm your host, Ted Harrington, and with me here today, we have someone that I really admire and respect from the security and compliance world, AJ Yan, the CEO of ByteCheck. AJ, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Ted. It's going to be a fun conversation, two security pros geeking out, so I'm excited.
Geeking out, indeed. We will geek out. I love it. So the origin of getting you on this show was a conversation that you and I were having. And I think I even interrupted. I might have even told you to shut up because what you were saying was so good that I wanted on the show. If I did, I apologize. So, but you started talking about the distinction between security and compliance. And what I'd like to do is just pick our conversation back up there. So let's start there and we'll go wherever the conversation flows. But what you were talking about, which I totally agree with and want to start here, is this idea that compliance doesn't necessarily mean you're secure, but if you're secure, you might be compliant. So why don't you just start telling us what your thinking and viewpoint is on that idea?
Yeah, you know, there's that saying that we all hear all the time, and it's true. Compliance is not security. Everybody says it. We always hear it. And I agree. I think you can easily get some kind of compliance report, a PCI report, SOC 2, whatever it may be, and you can still have gaping holes in your security and in your environment. However, I think my thought process and what I hope the industry continues to go towards is that security is compliant and can be compliant and should be compliant. And focusing on security is really all that you need to be compliant. I think over the past few years, with the additional frameworks that have come out and as organizations grow, they just start collecting these compliance certifications like badges. And it's just like, I'm HIPAA, I'm HITRUST, I'm CSA STAR, I'm PCI, I'm SOC 2. And now you're doing all this extra work and it's all the same stuff. They're all saying protect privileged users, protect your sensitive data, protect your resources by regularly checking for vulnerabilities. It's all of the same things. And sometimes organizations focus so much on a framework, they forget about the underlying reason for the compliance assessment, which is security, which is to prove that you're secure. So I really think the mindset has to shift to where we think of security as compliance. And I think that's where the whole DevSecOps model is really going, is that security is just embedded in everywhere. And that's my whole thought, is just, I'm a compliance guy, I make a living off of compliance reports. And I'll be the first to tell you that I don't think a compliance report makes you secure, just off of getting one. But if the way you go about it is to prove security, to actually improve security, then the result is you're gonna be compliant, but the real result is you're gonna be more secure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these two areas are inherently interwoven. You can't even necessarily unlink them in a lot of organizations, but there is a really remarkable difference between the two. And I'm curious to your thoughts on how we resolve this. So the nature of compliance is an effort at uniformity, and I'm maybe oversimplifying things, but the purpose of compliance is to be able to say, here's this thing that we all agree upon is a certain baseline, or maybe it's baseline's not even the right word, but we all agree that this is a thing and everyone needs to be like this thing. So that's sort of what compliance is like, this push for uniformity. But security inherently is customized and unique. Every organization has a different threat model. They have different architecture, different attack surfaces. They protect different assets. So by definition, every organization's approach to security, or not their approach, but how they measure or define security is different. So how do we dovetail these two, where one seeks uniformity and one by definition is inherently unique?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's that question is the problem I have with some of the compliance frameworks out there, like an ISO 27001 or a PCI or a FedRAMP, where they have prescriptive requirements. You must do X, Y, and Z. And if you don't do X, Y, and Z, you don't pass. And even if X, Y, and Z does not actually matter to your organization, you will fail this audit even if you don't do it. And it's just silly because, like you said, security takes context. Like, really, companies with great security, it's contextual. It's based off of their environment. It's based off of what's going on in their organization. It's not just some standard set of tools or processes to get through it. But that's why I love SOC 2. And I guess there's not a lot of people that would ever say they love SOC 2, but I'm one of the rare people that would say that. But it's because SOC 2 is customizable. They have this set of criteria. For example, there's one criteria that says you detect and protect malicious software in your environment. That means you can do anything. That doesn't mean that you installed an AV solution. That means maybe you're doing vulnerability assessments. Maybe you have an IDS tool. Maybe the way that you built your environment, it's not necessary for you to have AV in certain plot spots, but you can really customize it. The problem is SOC 2 is a framework that has to be issued by a CPA, a certified public accountant. Not the most technical people, right? The people that are going to want to dive into the technology. So these reports became cookie cutter. They just become the same reports that everybody sees. But one of the things that I love to do in SOC 2 is come up with custom controls that match your environment, that can actually address what you're doing and aren't just saying the same things regardless if you're hosted on AWS or GCP. Like, if you're hosted on AWS and a competitor of yours hosted on GCP, and you both have a SOC 2 reports, those reports should look very differently because it's completely different technology. Some of the ways that you do things on AWS, you can't even do that on GCP. So you should have a different report, but I guarantee you we could pick up SOC 2 reports and they're going to look the same. You're not going to have a control about S3 buckets in AWS, but we all know that's a big risk. And it's a SOC 2 report, it's a security report, and there's no S3 bucket controls. It's almost crazy when you think about that. So that's the one compliance framework I think that has the ability to really be a report that can be focused solely on security. However, I do think, and this is like my pie in the sky vision of creating a framework that's focused on like actual automated security, like actual DevSecOps principles, where we're actually, it's a technical report. It's not about how you're onboarding people. I don't care if you have a board of directors. It's like, can someone create a public bucket? And if they do, what happens? Like, what do you have in place to fix that automatically? And a report that tests those things. And I think that report, whatever framework comes, steals my idea and makes a lot of money off of it, is going to be like, finally, compliance reports are going to have value because it's going to actually tell you that these things are in place and they're going to prevent a breach. Not, I looked at it one time and I looked at evidence from 9 months ago. It's like, I literally saw the configurations and you cannot do something bad because of how they set it up. And I think that would be a really cool report, but long way to answer your question. I think SOC 2 helps you with that uniqueness of the security environment. The other frameworks, not so much. It's just because they're prescriptive. It's black or white.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I want to key in on something that you said a moment ago, where you said that companies sometimes will collect all these different badges, or I forget how you described it. It was really interesting the way you said it, but this idea of like HIPAA and SOC 2 and so on and so on and so on and so on. And I'm curious to your take on this. So it strikes me that there's probably a spectrum of why people or why organizations might do that. And it seems like one end of the spectrum is a marketing benefit, right? They want to be able to say to their customers, hey, look how secure we are. We've got this alphabet soup of stuff that we've gotten. And the other end of the spectrum is, and maybe spectrum's the wrong way to think about it, but another motivation is that people genuinely are looking for a way to actually improve their security. And they don't necessarily care about the designation as much as actually having something to measure against. So I guess my questions to you are two. One, do you agree with that organization? If not, how should we improve the organization of that idea? And two, what do you think is the primary driver of why people pursue compliance?
Yeah, I think the primary driver I see is market demand. Somebody knocked on the door and asked, a potential customer, vendor, investor, somebody said, hey, I want to do business with you. Prove to me that you're secure. You can answer this 300 question security questionnaire, and then you would have to do that for every single customer or vendor that pops up, or you can go have an auditor come in and you get one report and can give it out to many customers. Unfortunately, that's how most of these compliance assessments, that's how most of the customers that I talk to, they reach out to me because somebody else asked them to do this. And it's not really a proactive thing. It's not someone saying, I want to improve my security, so I'm going to go and get a compliance report. And I think that's an indictment on the industry as far as what we're doing from a compliance perspective. People don't associate it with security. So they'll, some organizations will, especially startups nowadays, you know, their CTOs are getting smarter and smarter and understand security principles. So a lot of the CTOs I talk to, they already have done a lot of great things from a security perspective before they've talked to me. And that's just because they focused on security earlier, but compliance and security weren't thought of at the same time. And I think when organizations get one assessment, they start to move into another market. So now healthcare is something that they're looking at. So now HIPAA becomes relevant. They start to move into the retailer. So now they have to get PCI. So it's just a natural progression as a company grows. But I do think there's a little bit of a luring into it with compliance firms. I'm a former consultant in that space too. You land and expand is the name of the game there, right? Where we would convince our clients, you know, hey, you might want to do this assessment. You might want to do it. It's great for us on the bottom line. And we tell them that it's going to be easy because they're already doing all these other assessments. So it should be easy to add them on. And that wasn't necessarily lying to them, but they do kind of go at it in a more proactive manner because they were encouraged by their third party assessors. But I don't think, you know, I've worked with a lot of organizations that went from having no compliance frameworks to having like 7 or 8, and it was all business demand. You know, it wasn't that they were like, you know, CSA Star looks really cool and I think it's a cool cloud security framework and I want to do that. It was, oh, AWS has a CSA Star and now we want to do it too, because we want to associate ourselves at that level and we're competing against them. And that's what it comes down to, which is why I hope we can shift and either come up with or do something to make it a lower level before you start getting those knocks on the door, just a way to prove that you're secure in a compliance perspective, I think would be really valuable. But right now it's definitely reactive.
What do you make of this condition, and tell me if you think that this condition doesn't exist. I think that it does. I'll put my opinion out first. That compliance programs inherently require a lot of compromise to them, meaning in order for them to satisfy a wide audience or to be able to work for a wide audience, there needs to be a lot of trade-offs that maybe inherently might water down some of the teeth in a particular program. They also take a long time in order to actually iterate and adapt and implement whatever the new version is. And that is certainly not as fast as the attackers are evolving, nor even as fast as technology is evolving. So again, two questions. Do you think that's correct or is it incorrect? And if so, how? And then the second question is, what do we do about this?
Yeah, I think you are correct I always talk about this, and I'm in the SOC 2 space, but whatever. If you have a report that goes from January 1, 2020, right, through December 31st, 2020, that's a normal SOC 2 type 2, 12 months. And I'm a new customer. I show up October 2021 and I say, hey, are you secure? You're like, yeah, of course I'm secure. I got a SOC 2 report. They're going to hand you a SOC 2 report from 23 months ago. Who knows what that environment looks like now? Like it's not really doing anything for me. I'm not going to really learn anything about your environment that an auditor may have sampled a change from January 2020. That's not teaching me anything about your environment. So I think the idea that the compliance activities, they take up a lot of time, they take up a lot of effort, and the value of them, it's probably gone in about 2 months after that exercise. It's probably a wasted effort. And I think that's where you have to leverage technology. You have to leverage technology, but you also have to treat compliance assessments the same way you talked about in Hackable with vulnerability assessments. You have to rescan. You have to perform reassessments because it's that second look, it's that follow-up that usually you catch some more things. And I think with compliance, and there's a lot of tools out there, I'm of course building one at ByteCheck that will monitor controls year round and that continuously, that this idea of continuous compliance. And I think people think when they think of continuous compliance, they're thinking of an auditor all the time. And I don't think that's, auditors are not going to be in the future of this. And a manual auditor, a human, can't actually assess a cloud environment well. Like, it's just, they can't do especially not an auditor, because auditors have to focus on controls. They're not focused on technology. So they're going to spend way more time on controls and understanding controls and doing the paperwork and the reporting side than they are going to do the technology. So there, in the compliance space, there's going to have to be tools that help enforce and continuously check these controls. And that would allow us to have reports that are actually valuable and that are keeping up with the speed of what the attackers are doing. And I think that's why we need a new framework, honestly. I just think the frameworks right now, they're not proving anything. I'm not learning anything about your environment if you show me a report from 12 months ago, especially because if you think about the way that auditors test, and this is just insight from being an auditor, we would go in and we'd sample, right? Maybe you have 1,000 databases, and I say, I want to see 44 of your databases to prove that you encrypt your data at rest. And I go out and get these. I see all the configurations. But what about 6 months ago? were these data stores encrypted 6 months ago? There's no way that I can tell. Yes, I could go get a log dump, right? And I could see when did these resources change, but I'm not looking through 12 months of logs. No auditor is. Most auditors won't even understand what to look at. So we're testing things and we're saying, yes, for 12 months, you were compliant, but in reality, that's not really the case. It's you know, because you're spinning up new resources, because humans come into play, things fall out of compliance. Threats change too. What about a 0 day? How does an audit account for 0 days? It doesn't. So I think you're correct in everything that you're saying, and I think it requires a model of. The same way we're talking about, the whole industry talks about DevSecOps and embedding security into every part of the development process, from the build all the way to the release. You have to embed compliance there too, where compliance is constantly being assessed, because if not, it's not going to be valuable.
I love the theme you're bringing up here, which has to do with change. And fundamentally, technology changes, the attack landscape changes, the attackers themselves change, and you correctly identified what happens when we wait too long to deal with change. So how should a company think about their compliance program if these conditions exist? One, things change rapidly. Two, the requirement for many compliance programs is, you know, once a year. And as you said, that could then roll into, you know, the following year. Yet they still need to satisfy this compliance because they need to satisfy a customer or whatever. How do we unpack all that? I mean, automation, obviously, I'm excited about what you're describing, that there's ways to have continuous compliance. But is that really the sole future? I mean, the way you phrased it, auditors will be part of this. Are we talking about like the future of Uber doesn't have drivers? or are there no auditors in the future of compliance?
No, I think you still would need auditors, because technically auditors are supposed to be trusted advisors. They're supposed to be able to come in and provide guidance and advice, not just document controls and read screenshots all day. And that's what auditors spend most of their time doing now, is just reviewing screenshots and Excel sheets. And they're not actually talking to the clients. They're just looking at evidence and asking them to click around on the screen. So I think auditors are going to be able to get back to being those advisors, get back to providing like actual value from a trusted advisor guidance perspective. But I think organizations should, if you don't have any compliance report and you know it's on the horizon, I would strongly consider SOC 2, regardless of if you're in the EU or the States. In the EU, many people opt for ISO. Problem with ISO is the result of it is a certificate. Literally does not tell you anything. You just get a certificate. I don't know where you're hosted. I don't know any of this information. I have no information about the scope. So I would tell people, you know, start with SOC 2 and find a SOC 2 partner, tool, firm, whatever the terminology is, that understands your technical environment. The same way that you wouldn't just go with a random vulnerability scan tool or a random vulnerability assessment partner or a random monitoring tool. If you're a completely Linux shop, you're not going to go get Windows tools to monitor your Linux environment, right? So don't go get an auditor that doesn't understand the cloud. don't go work with people that don't actually understand where you're hosted, and make those the problem right now that I see in the industry is clients are not asking the right questions of their auditors. They're asking, how long will this take? How much will it cost? And will my customers be satisfied with the report? Those questions are irrelevant because a lot of those questions will be answered depending on the technology and the technical capacity of the auditors that you're working with. If they understand AWS, regardless if they have a tool or not, they'll know how to generate reports out of the tool so that you can have less evidence. If they don't, you're going to be grabbing screenshots of things that you don't need to grab screenshots, things that you can generate a report from. So I think a company should consider SOC 2 and then really vet auditors for technical knowledge. If an auditor can read, they can understand the framework. So don't hire an auditor for their knowledge of frameworks. Knowledge of frameworks is great. Like, I know SOC 2 in and out, all of the different criteria. But what really helps our customers is that I understand the cloud, because I can help them actually have a report that communicates that they're secure from cloud security threats. So I think this requirement is not going to go away. My idea of this like cloud automated security report is going to take a very long time for this to come to fruition. So SOC 2s and PCIs and all of these are going to be around. I would just encourage people to try to get security value out of these audits. Think about, how do I make myself more secure by going through an audit, not how do I get a report? Don't worry about the report. Worry about, there's no real way, I don't think, you should be able to go through an audit, especially a manual one, maybe with a tool, but with the manual one, without your auditor finding a weakness, they should find something. We shouldn't have just an automatic clean report every time. That screams to me something's off. There's no way you were perfect, especially growing organizations. You see an organization go from 20 people to 150 people, and then they have a clean SOC 2. It's like, well, you guys didn't have any missteps in all of this hiring or anything happened. I think that's not completely accurate. So, organizations have to change their mindset on compliance, stop checking the box, look for more security value. I would suggest SOC 2 and then really, really examine who you're working with. Think of an auditor as a security partner, not as an audit partner.
I love this idea you brought up that might be surprising actually to a lot of people listening to this, that not all auditors are all the same, because inherently we're sort of conditioned to think of compliance as uniform, right? Well, if the controls are there, find someone who can check against the control. So it almost doesn't matter who the human is, but the point you're making is the opposite, which is that what you should be looking for is someone who actually understands the unique circumstances of that company. That's a brilliant, definitely definition of tech done different way to think about this challenge. And you make this advocacy to really vet your partner. So if you were going to say, and I'm putting you on the spot here, so if you don't have these three, we can always put these in show notes or something. But if you were going to say, these are the three questions that someone looking to hire an auditor should ask in order to vet them, what would those three questions be?
Yeah. The first would be, how does your process or tool help me reduce the amount of evidence that I need to collect from my cloud environment? And whether the auditor has a manual process or has technology, if they understand AWS, GCP, or Azure, they should know how to use things like Security Center in Azure or Trusted Advisor on AWS or whatever GCP calls their security one now, because they change the name like every other year. But they should know, just off of in that questionnaire, what are some of the ways that they'll help reduce the evidence that you have to gather from your cloud environment? The other thing I would ask them is, who's working on my project? Because oftentimes you're going to be told, and you're going to talk to one person and they're going to have all of these AWS certs. They're going to be super technical. And then the person that's actually doing your assessment and looking at your environment has never seen AWS before, doesn't even know what AWS is. So I would really ask about the project team, ask who is actually going to be assigned to the project. What is their level of technical knowledge and familiarity with AWS? Ask to talk to them. That's something that only a few customers actually did in the in the past when I was at a larger consulting firm where they actually wanted to talk to the people working on the engagement. And I thought it was brilliant. Like, why wouldn't you want to talk to the people that are going to audit your environment? Of course, like, and then vet those people the same way you're not going to hire a compliance manager and not ask them what they know about your technical environment. Why would you go pay 50, 60 grand for an auditor to and not know what they know? You know, ask those questions. And then the last one, I would ask, what are the chances of you getting a clean report? The answers to that question will be pretty eye-opening, depending on the auditor, because my answer to that question is very low. It's a very low chance that you'll get a clean report. And that's because our platform sees into AWS. It looks into Azure. It looks into GitHub. It looks into all your different tools that you're using. So, you know, chances are that things are going to be wrong at certain times, and we're going to help you automate things and help you put in places. But the good security is going to find holes. A good security tool is going to find weaknesses, and that's what you want. You want us to find it. You don't want someone else to find it. You want us to see when an S3 bucket goes public. You don't want somebody bad to find that out. So you know, I think that answer to that question will tell you a lot about the firm, because if they're honest with you and they understand a cloud environment, they'll understand that there's a huge potential that you're going to have a report that's not clean. But having a not clean report, I don't think is a bad thing. It's actually pretty common. Everybody thinks SOC 2 reports are generally clean, but there's like weird AICPA language that buries the actual status of the report that no one understands. And so everybody's like, yeah, I got a SOC 2. But most reports have issues because it's impossible to go through a 12-month assessment without issues. So those are some of the three questions. And I think all of them kind of come down to the same thing, just like vet the partner. Just really ask deep questions about the technical expertise. That's something that most people don't do, because they're just like, do you know SOC 2? How many of these have you done? Are you allowed to sign the reports? Cool. How much is it going to cost? But that isn't... doesn't really tell you what it's going to be like. If you're going to start getting asked questions about SQL databases and you tell them that you don't have SQL databases and they're just still asking you questions. And I've had customers that say that. They're like, I've literally told my PCI auditor 10 times, I don't have this technology, and they keep asking me for the evidence because their work paper says they have to ask for this evidence. And that's the stuff you don't need to deal with, especially not now. Like there's just a better way to go about this.
I love that. I mean, all of those questions, certainly that's a really helpful guide, but that third one is really interesting. You know, almost like it's not a trick question, but it's a question of expertise in terms of like, is this going to be clean or not? What's really striking to me about that is we run into that as well on the security assessment side, where what people really want, and I assume this is what they want with compliance too, they really want a quote unquote clean bill of health. Right? They want to be able to say, I have no vulnerabilities, so I can go show that to my customer. And unfortunately, that's not a practical reality, and that's okay. And it sounds like you're echoing exactly the same sentiment, because it's all about getting better, right? And finding those issues and improving them.
Exactly. Exactly. Like reports, SOC 2 reports should get better over time. Like you should find something in year one, and then you next year you have a control that fixed that thing that was found in year one. But maybe in year two, we found something else, and it just keeps going. And that's how it should be. But we're kind of preaching to the choir to each other here.
we're building our own little echo chamber on this one, this one episode. So let's talk about penetration testing. Right before we got on, you and I started having this conversation. I was like, wait, let's talk about this on the show. And you were telling me this story about how the way that you've thought about penetration testing before has maybe been a little more loosely defined, and now you're sort of rethinking how to approach it. So maybe just introduce kind of where you were thinking in terms of the role of penetration testing and what your new thinking is now, and let's have that conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I have to give credit to you for the change of thought, definitely, because Hackable was eye-opening on this and helped me kind of see the flaws in how I've looked at pen testing from a compliance perspective, definitely. And I think I definitely have some shame too, like some Game of Thrones type of shame, because I've thought about this before with the way that we word pen test controls, is that it's not saying much. In most compliance reports, you're going to see a control that says the company performs a penetration test on at least an annual basis and remediates critical and high vulnerabilities. That's going to be in probably every SOC 2 report out there. But what does that actually mean? I thought that before. After reading your book, I really understand it means nothing, because that can be so many different things. I saw recently there's like tools out there that's called themselves external pen test tools. And they're just running like an basically vulnerability scan against IPs. But they're calling themselves a pen test and they get a pen test report. And from an audit perspective, that's all we care about is, do you have a pen test? Here's my pen test report. And I think that's doing a disservice to the audit and to the customer, because we're giving them credit for something that's actually not adding security value, which a control at its core is supposed to mitigate a risk. So if I'm saying that you're doing a pen test, it's because it's supposed to be mitigating some risk. And the way that the current way we test pen tests, I don't think it's really mitigating risk. So I'm actually really excited about this. And something that I want to do is really reshape how we assess that penetration test requirement in SOC 2 reports, especially at ByteCheck. One of the things I'm immediately going to do is change the control in our platform. We're no longer going to have a control that says pen test. It's going to say vulnerability assessments. And I'm going to dive in. I haven't thought of the control wording all the way out yet, but I'm going to dive into some of the details of what you talked about in Hackable about what a true vulnerability assessment means, and make sure that we're assessing that. Make sure we're actually testing what did the vulnerability assessment look at? Was it a white box versus a black box? And why is that important? And I think those are things that whenever I find something out in the security industry, I immediately start to feel bad for my customers that I had before I knew this knowledge. Cause I'm like, man, like I wanna give better advice to these customers. Like I wanna go back to my customers and be like, let's stop talking about pen tests. Let's start talking about vulnerability assessments, and let's consider what you're doing, why you're doing it, and dive deep into that process instead of just being like, are you doing a pen test? Yes. Cool. Who does it? All right. That's great. Can I get the report? Awesome. We're done. And that's it, but that's not adding any value. So yeah, I know I'm on a little bit of a soapbox, but that's kind of the mindset shift. And it all really came from reading Hackable. So kudos to you.
Well, I'm flattered and honored that you would say that. And it's really fulfilling to see someone, you know, be able to think differently because of that body of work. One thing that you said in your answer there that really resonates with me is this idea that you framed it as you feel bad, but really what you were saying was, you know, you learn new things, you know how to do it better. You want to go help your customers do it better. And that right there, I almost interrupted you because I was so powerful, but I was like, no, you got to finish this thought because it's so powerful. That is the kind of mindset and attitude that definitely delivers security. I mean, that's what security is about. You're never done. It's never complete. You're never like standing on top of the Olympic gold podium and like, okay, I'm done. Never. Yeah. It's all about, you know, can you get a little bit better today? And hearing you say that was, I hope that people listening to this are like, I now know how I should think as well about not only learning and teaching myself, learning skills, but applying those insights. So you're definitely the kind of person who is constantly learning. What's a piece of advice that you have for people who are listening to this, who are obviously, you know, pre-qualified as learners anyway, they're listening to a podcast about how to think differently, but what's worked for you in terms of reshaping your thinking, changing your mind? What advice would you give to people?
Yeah, there's two things that really helped me out a lot this year, especially launching a company, focus and goal setting and just being willing to just get stuff done. It's required to be an entrepreneur, especially launching a company during a global pandemic. It requires a lot. So two things that helped were meditation. I meditate daily. And it just really helps keep me present, helps me focus on what matters. And I don't get too wound up about things, or the highs don't take me too high and the lows don't take me too low, because I'm always staying in the moment. And it's almost to a fault, because I'll forget to think too far ahead. I went from a military mindset of planning literally every aspect of my life to the socks that I was wearing, to now I'm just like, I live in the moment. I'm going back to my real California roots. Meditation has helped. And then I followed this principle called the 90-91 rule. And it's helped me accomplish a lot of things, where I spend for 90 days straight, I spend the first 90 minutes of my day on one thing. I cut off Slack, I cut off email, I cut off all of other distractions. And I just focus the first 90 minutes on just completing one thing. And that could be one thing for 30 days. That one thing can change, but it's literally just doing one thing for 90 minutes. And the amount of stuff that I get done in a 90-day period of just relentless focus for 90 minutes a day is ridiculous. I've been able to just to power through a lot of stuff by that just 90 minutes. And if you think about 90 minutes in the, at that moment, it's a long time, like an hour and a half is a good amount of time to get some stuff done. But if you think about it in the course of your day, yeah, not that much. And you probably waste that time on doing a lot worse things. So I would tell people, figure out a way to lock in and focus. And then a lot of people say like, I'm not a good meditator because every time I sit down, I close my eyes, I think about something else. That's fine. Just give it a shot. Just sit down and take a break for 10 minutes, essentially. And it works for me. And that's what I would you know, suggest to folks.
So I've never heard of this 90-91 rule, at least not by that name, but the principles sound very familiar to me. So is the idea that for 90 days, those first 90 minutes, every one of those 90 days is you're working on the same thing, or is it every day you work on whatever you want that's the top priority for that day?
Yeah, so the original concept is one thing. You focus on one thing for those 90 days. I've adapted it because I'm launching a startup and I can't focus on only one thing for 90 days. But in the early days of Bite Check, that was the product. I would spend the first 90 minutes of my day solely 100% on the product and just literally do nothing else. And it was amazing because I would lock in on like one small thing that I probably wouldn't have spent that time on if I wasn't locked in. But now I kind of adapted it to where I just use that first 90 minutes to be locked in on whatever that task is for the day. Sometimes it's like a week thing where it's like this whole, for example, we were just building out our Azure integration. So over the break, my 90-91 for the week was at Microsoft Azure and building out this integration and just solely focused on Microsoft and figuring out their weird APIs. But it's the whole principle is just focusing. It's just locking in. And we have so many distractions nowadays with Slack and email and our phones and LinkedIn and all this other stuff that just locking in for a very short period of time can exponentially, it's like security. You do little things and over time it exponentially helps you improve like in a crazy manner. But oftentimes it's just getting that lock in moment is the hardest. It's just like focusing for that short period of time. But if you're starting it out, I would encourage you just to pick one thing, whether that's like reading a book, getting a cert, whatever it is, especially people trying to get into the field, just focus on one thing. And that's something that I live by is I do not care about results for the first 3 months of me doing anything. Whether that's posting on LinkedIn. When I first started getting active on LinkedIn, I ignored the results for 3 months. Whenever I'm starting to work out towards a new goal, I ignore the results for 3 months. And it's really, I'm a former athlete. I played basketball at Florida State. So I've learned the power of putting in work in the summer for a championship the next spring. And you learn that the work you do in the summer, it matters, but you can't expect to see the results in the summer. You're going to see the results when the season comes. So anybody that's out there trying to do something really difficult, ignore the results for the first 3 months. Just keep putting the work in and then start to think about the results after those 90 days. Give yourself a chance to really see what works and what doesn't work.
Yeah, this concept of focus really resonates with me. I mean, what you describe is that's how I wrote a book. When I sat down to do it, many people, my wife included, were like, are you crazy? You already are like work all the, you're, it's so intense what you're already doing. How can you possibly have time to write a book? And that was a really good question. That's a really fair question. And the way that I did it was, I found a way to clear the decks in the morning, meaning I got up earlier. So I started getting up at what is probably pretty crazy for a lot of people. I got up 4:45 AM. And I would work on my book for about 2 hours and then I'd go exercise and stretch. And by the time I got to the office around 9, I had already done more with my day than most people were going to do like all week. And it's because of this same principle that you're describing of focus, like focusing all your concentration on one thing. The idea of multitasking is a complete farce. You know, all it's two things halfway is not the same as one thing the whole way. And so I totally agree with you. And I like this idea you just described of not focusing on the results for 30 days. And the way you framed it of you practice in the spring, or sorry, the training you do in the summer delivers championships in the spring. So for the person out there who's like, that's nice, AJ, but there's no way I can focus for 90 minutes, certainly not for 90 days, and certainly not on one thing. What's one small thing that you think they could do to start?
One thing that I do to force myself to lock in when I'm studying for something or just really want to lock in on some concept is I'll, on my iPhone, I'll replace, like if I have LinkedIn in a certain location, I'll replace LinkedIn with a flashcard app that has the flashcards I'm studying or the Audible book that I'm reading at that time or whatever it is that I'm doing, maybe like a Google Drive document that I need to get through. And I'll replace the where that social media icon is with that thing that I'm doing, because those distractions are the ones that cost you the most time. When you just pick up your phone for something else, you go to LinkedIn because you were supposed to do something else. And if you hit a button and now you're in your flashcards and you're supposed to be studying for a solutions architect professional, and now you're just locked into your flashcards, it's going to reinforce this concept of all right, I need to lock in. I it's going to be kind of a shame. You're going to be looking at yourself in the mirror, and you have to, I mean, it takes self-discipline, but it's little tricks like that where you just have to be smarter than your brain. You have to outsmart yourself. We can't fight a lot of the things psychology, like these phones. If everybody's seen, I haven't even seen Social Dilemma, but I've heard about it and I understand the psychology behind it. They're designed to make us addicted. So if you know that, trick yourself, like force yourself to do different things, use the technology in a way to allow you to lock in and try to do little tricks. I love how you phrased it with waking up early of clearing the decks. I wake up at 4:45 every day. And my sole motivation for waking up early is to beat my kids up because I do not like waking up to crying kids. I have a 4-year-old and a 3-year-old. So the last 4 years, it's been to beat them before they wake up. But you can accomplish so much by just waking up. And like you said, by 9 o'clock, you've accomplished more already than most people do in a week. If you can get your workout in, get your meditation, whatever it is. And like, I'm very like religious about my mornings. I need that peace. I always say, like, if I'm drinking my coffee and there's a kid not climbing on me, I'm going to have a good day. Like it's going to be all right. But if I don't make it to that coffee without the kid climbing on me, it's probably gonna be bad. So I would encourage people, wake up a little bit early. It's powerful. It's hard at first. But waking up early allows you to just tap into a lot more time than most people just are wasting. They're sleeping.
Oh, man. We are so aligned on that. Well, AJ, you've been really, really awesome. Thank you so much for spending some time here together with us today. As we wrap up, is there one final parting thought that you might share about the future of whether it's whatever you want to talk about, whether it's focus or compliance, but like pull out your crystal ball and help our audience see, you know, what's coming around the corner in your worldview?
Yeah, I think from a compliance perspective and just security in general, especially with the impact that COVID-19 had on compliance programs and security budgets, organizations are going to continue to find easier ways to get through these assessments and ways that are more technically accurate. So if you're a firm out there and you're fighting the revolution that's going on in the compliance space of using technology, you got to stop that fight because it's coming. And if you're a company that's still going through manual audits, there's better ways to do it. Leverage technologies and leverage partners that understand the cloud. I think that's the future, is where companies and people in the industry are going to care more about the security and technical knowledge of auditors than they are the controls knowledge. And I think that's going to be a great sign.
Awesome, man. AJ Yon, CEO of ByteCheck, thank you so much for spending some time here with us together today. And for everyone else listening, if you want to yourself appear on the podcast or learn more about it, just visit tedharrington.com/podcast, and we'll catch you next time. Thanks a lot.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Tech Done Different podcast with Ted Harrington. If you learned something new and this conversation made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.